Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound packs of juicy Kroger red, green, or black seedless grapes for $3.99 with your card and a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packs of flavorful Private Selection 80% Lean Angus ground chuck for $4.99 each with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is your burning hand. It's right here.
I'm going to my cave. I'm going to find my power.
No! Don't deal with it the way those dead people do. Come on!
I get the point, okay?
No,
please.
But your feeling is premature and light. This is the greatest moment of your life, man. And you're off somewhere miserable.
I am not!
Shut up. Our fathers were models for God. If our fathers failed, what does that tell you about God?
No,
listen to me. Consider the possibility that God does not like you. He never wanted you. In all probability, he hates you. This is not the worst thing that can happen.
It is.
We don't need him.
We don't. I agree. I gotta
fight. Fuck damnation, man. Fuck redemption. We are God's unwanted children. So be it.
Okay, so fuck you.
Listen.
It's only after we've lost everything that we're free to do anything. Congratulations. One step closer to hitting bottom.
I'm back. Miss me? By back, it means it's that old-time audio podcast that I've been doing for so many moons. It's not Video Kill the Radio Star, but close to it, as video seems to be in demand by both audience and astral guests. There is more, but I am here, and I hope you're here for this. This is how I began, and who knows when the last audio-only version will be. I just go with the flow of Sophia, Artemis, Santa Muerte, and our Lord and Savior Elvis. I just keep spreading, as Philip K. Dick said, that Gnostic gnosis in trashy form.
I gotta have more cowbell!
And as Charles Bukowski wrote, find what you love and let it kill you. Let it drain you of your all. Let it cling onto your back and weigh you down into eventual nothingness. Let it kill you and let it devour your remains. For all things will kill you, both slowly and fastly. But it's much better to be killed by a lover.
To live is to risk it all. Otherwise, you're just an inert chunk of randomly assembled molecules drifting wherever the universe blows you.
By the goddesses I mentioned, I have some unforgiving, demanding lovers. But I wouldn't have it any other way. Because shit got serious in this Milli Vanilli reality, here at the end of the world, in this age of Hermes, Philip K. Dick world, and Gnostic times.
Praying to the gods to have mercy on us all. The gods have no mercy, that's why they're gods.
And for those of you who just arrived at the virtual Alexandria for the first time, by no accident but propelled by the winds of dangerous fortuna, where are you?
This is blasphemy! This is madness! Mush!
Aeon Byte, an initiation by conversation into the dark corners of myth, magic, and meaning. A crash course in cult culture and conspiracy. A virtuous virus invoking and informing history, holiness, and heresy. Each week, I, your host, Miguel Connor, commandeers your connection to bring you the most accepted and rejected scholars and provocateurs to your attention. Fun, compelling, and deeply weird, this is the blow-your-mind cocktail party conversation you always wanted to listen in on. And you deserve to be here, for you are a shining, crazy diamond that should be seen and can ignite the universe with so much wonder. You are amazing and have a holy purpose. That's cosmic law, and don't let anyone or anything convince you otherwise. You're writing your own gospel and living your own myth. You are a modern-day Tom Sawyer, your mind not for rent to any god or government. Time to fly. Time to bleed. Time to show the world your scars, O you of the broken places. Time to rise like a phoenix with the fire of primeval alchemy.
I know we're all pretty small in the big scheme of things. And I suppose the most you can hope for is to make some kind of difference. But what kind of difference have I made? What in the world is better because of me? What difference has my life made to anyone?
As perhaps the audio-only podcast crumbles but still holds so much value, it seems like a good show to talk about ancient archaeology and alt history. As Alan Moore said, all history is fiction, and we're done with the victors of history rewriting even reality itself. We're done with their Gorgon shit. So get ready for some ball-tingling gnosis, as once again, we are joined by the brilliant Andrew Collins to discuss his latest book, Karahan Tepe, Civilization of the Anunnaki and the Cosmic Origins of the Serpent of Eden.
Amazing thing about snakes is that they reproduce spontaneously. That's why somebody you don't trust, you call a snake. How can you trust a guy who can literally go fuck themselves?
Don't you think that expression will come from the Adam and Eve story? When snake tempted Eve to bite the apple?
Hey, snakes were fucking themselves long before Adam and Eve showed up to you.
By Odin's dingleberries, you know Andrew will bring mind-blowing but sober research to the table. Everyone gets the full interview, I say. But for all subs, Graham Pong provides his research and how Andrew's work ties into his discoveries about Atlantis and the secret truth about human evolution. Don't miss it.
Some of you may die, but it's a sacrifice I am willing to make.
We keep going deeper into those rabbit holes for those timeless treasures and red pill suppositories. I will continue to serve you as your psychopomp of contraband truths. And thank you so much for being on this journey, aeons in the making. In many ways, I feel as if Aeon Byte has just begun. As if the restoration of Hagia Sophia has just reached maximum velocity.
My father says that almost the whole world is asleep. Everybody you know, everybody you see, everybody you talk to. He says that only a few people are awake, and they live in a state of constant, total amazement.
After Astrognosis in August, I felt like part of me died, and it sent me into a sadness and slight madness, mostly because I didn't know what had died or what part of me I needed to say goodbye to. It's hard to explain, but as it was a successful and memorable event, some dark power stabbed me to the core, and I had to bring myself from the edge of psychic destruction and into a state of rapid-fire transformation. Yet part of me did perish, and I'm still in funeral mode. Ever feel that way?
But what is grief? If not love, persevering.
Since then, though, the mission of Gnosis hasn't changed. I'll keep telling you the same solutions to play the game of Saturn. Look inward, as the inner journey is essential. As the great philosopher Steve Miller sang in Jungle Love, the question to everyone's answer is usually asked from within. Go inward, but make sure to touch some grass. Nature holds your salvation and destruction, and ultimately it's the same dang thing.
I didn't build this system, nor did I fuck it up.
Don't look at the stars, but experience them. To simply get that old as above, so below catharsis you've been looking for all of your life. As Plotinus wrote, the stars are like letters that inscribe themselves in every moment in the sky. Everything in the world is full of signs. All events are coordinated. All things depend on each other. Everything breathes together.
It's like we've forgotten who we are, Tom. Explorers, pioneers, not caretakers. Well, we used to look up in the sky and wonder at our place in the stars.
What else? Oh yeah, catch the mist. Catch the myth. A symbolic, magical, and mythical life is the only life worth living, as long as it's paired with helping the least of your brothers. Like Jungian June Singer wrote in A Gnostic Book of Hours, myths are true expressions of our inner selves, revealed cryptically in image, symbol, and metaphor. They are something like dreams. Rationally, they may not ring true, but in a psychological sense, they express people's inner processes through the use of ingenious devices that conceal what must be concealed and reveal what must be revealed.
Just awe-inspiring stuff.
And as Gordon White said, magic is the felt sense that our role in the cosmos is co-creative.
It's like God's vagina.
Thirdly, have an experience and worry less about understanding. That will come in time. Jung said symbols are meant to be experienced more than deciphered. And as Jan Osman wrote about ancient Egypt theology, the pyramid doesn't stand for something. It makes something visible. That's why you are here in the Black Iron Prison, to make things visible that were occulted by the Archons.
To quote the great Joseph Campbell, he said, "It's by going down into the abyss where we recover the treasures of life. Where you stumble, there lies your treasure." To the ironic twist of the unknown.
Lastly, as I perhaps narrate this from some grave, let me end with two summary quotes. The first one is from Jim Quick, who said, "If an egg is broken by outside force, life ends. If broken by inside force, life begins. Great things always begin from inside."
It's been a brilliant journey of self-awakening. Now you've simply got to ask yourself this: what is happiness to you?
The last is perhaps the central tenet of Aeon Bight, and it won't surprise you that it's from the Gospel of Thomas. It goes, "If you bring forth what is within you, what you have will save you. If you do not have that within you, what you do not have within you will kill you."
Such a disappointment. We can make anything we fancy in this arena of infinite promise. And this is what we come up with? Weapons? War? Surely we have more imagination than that.
Bukowski might disagree, but that's all I got. Led us to the interview with Andrew. Ah, F it. How about more from Miller in Jungle Love? You live in a world of illusion where everything's peaches and cream. We all face a scarlet conclusion. We spend our time in a dream.
Did you know Joseph Heller titled his book Catch 18, but his editor arbitrarily changed it to Catch 22.
Well, for as long as I can remember,
that's what being alive has felt like. Can't have form without space. Can't experience light without dark.
We're stuck.
Yeah, and any time you try to hold on to one thing,
slips away.
I've never been able to describe this feeling inside of me, but I think that's it. Catch 22.
It's like a void.
But not. It's like empty, but solid.
Yes. Empty, but solid. Right under the surface.
You think other people feel this way?
I know George doesn't. I hope June never does. Oh no. Maybe we're not normal. Maybe we're too fucked up.
Maybe normal people are just delusional, fucked up people.
Either way, that's why I don't believe in God.
What do you mean?
Why would a God make it like this?
Well, if God is everything, then we're God. That means God is just like us. Maybe that's why everything is the way it is.
God's just trying not to feel alone in nothingness.
You have never talked to anybody like this before.
Me neither.
This is the Aeon Bide interview. And with us, we have the pleasure of being joined again by Andrew Collins to discuss his new book, Karahan Tepe, Civilization of the Anunnaki and the Cosmic Origins of the Serpent of Eden. Andrew, thank you very much for coming back on the show.
My pleasure, Miguel. Plenty to talk about, as usual.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful book. And you cover so much ground and unveil so much important information that leads not just to the sources of civilization, but really the sources of human consciousness. Very important stuff today as humanity has lost its ability to tap into their unconscious, but we'll certainly get into it. With us, too, we've got Graham Pong. Graham, how are you doing?
Doing very well, Miguel. It's my pleasure to interact with Andrew. I've read his books. His work was integral to my research that I was doing. So it's my pleasure to see what's new that he's come out with.
Indeed, yes. Graham has done a lot of work on also an ancient archaeology. So we've got a good trio here. So, well, why don't we start with the book? Tell us about the book. It's not something you wrote from the comfort of your desk, but this is something you've seen face to face, right, Andrew?
Well, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I've just come back from Turkey, where I was actually, viewing these same places like Göbekli Tepe, Karahan Tepe, new sites like Seyburj, and others in the area, looking towards their latest discoveries, or in some cases seeing them for the first time, because it's really, really important to get a hanger on this high culture that existed just after the end of the last ice age. The archaeologists today refer to it as Taş Tepeli, which is Turkish, and it means stone or stony hills. The stone refers to the fact that they work with stone, creating these incredible, stone enclosures with T-shaped pillars and huge monoliths in the center. They cut out rooms into bedrock, and they quite literally are building these structures into hillsides and artificial mounds, which are known as tepes or hoyaks. And these are like layer cakes of human activity. And that's the tepe side of it. So, it's Taş Tepeli, as they call it. I would say that we're looking at the first post-Ice Age civilization, one that I think was probably remembered in myth and legend, not just amongst the Hebrews and the Semitic peoples, probably as the story of the Watchers and the Nephilim of the Book of Enoch, but also in Sumerian and Babylonian tradition, the whole story of the Anunnaki. All of these were said to have been human-like wisdom bringers that gave humanity the rudiments of civilization. Obviously, this is something we can break down as we go along. And it's something that I've been pursuing now for at least 30 years. I first talked about it in my book, From the Ashes of Angels, that came out in 1996. And as I was writing that, obviously the previous year, the first spades were going into the ground at Göbekli Tepe. I would have no knowledge of its discovery until the year 2000. It was kept secret. Wow. Because it was such a big deal. And of course, when that came, it was like, well, here's the mother load. This is essentially what you've been talking about. You said that this area was the cradle of civilization. You would find a lost chapter of history there. The prime movers, who I believe were shamans, who almost certainly dressed in cloaks of feather, certainly on occasions, are referred to in these texts as like human angels. The Watchers, for instance, in the Book of Enoch are said to wear cloaks of feathers or to be birdmen or to fly through the air like eagles. This is clearly, in my opinion, a reference to shamans and shamanism. I predicted that this would be there. And of course, we got Göbekli Tepe. I've written about that in various books, including one called Göbekli Tepe, Genesis of the Gods. And now we have what you might call a sister site of Göbekli Tepe called Karahan Tepe. And this one is even more enigmatic than Göbekli Tepe. I mean, Göbekli Tepe is a series of stone enclosures on the top of a hillside, which is at the tail end of the Anti-Taurus range of mountains. And, you know, to me, it's almost like a cathedral. You know, you have big enclosures, you have small enclosures. I think that they probably had different functions. You probably had people coming here, you know, almost like on pilgrimages, you know, to perform rituals, maybe to get healing, you know, to maybe seek omens and oracles, whatever. However, I think it's pretty sort of formalized from what I can see. But when you get to Karahan Tepe, it's completely different. Yes, of course, you've still got the stone enclosures, the T-shaped pillars, and, you know, some of those are proving to be really interesting. However, what you've also got is the first rock architecture in human history. You've got whole rooms, whole or partial interconnected rooms cut actually out of the bedrock. And one of them is the so-called Pillars Shrine. Now, this is this huge room out of the floor of which you have these massive pillars that are cut out of the bedrock itself. You have 10 of those. An 11th one has been brought in and slotted into a hole in the ground. Plus, in the wall, you've got this huge human head that's as much as three times the size of a normal human head. And, I mean, it's very striking in appearance, and it's clearly on a long neck that sort of like vertically goes downwards below it, which has horizontal striations on it that make it clear that this is some kind of snake or serpent, or what I call a snake genius. In other words, you know, a spirit in the form of a snake with a human head. And this begins to tell us a little bit about what's going on at Karahan, because many of these enclosures have a snake imagery associated with them. You know, it's carved on walls, it's carved on pillars. You know, even the structures themselves, I show, two of which seem to be modeled on the head of an actual snake. So in other words, you know, the actual design that they created into the bedrock was the head of a snake itself, which I find extraordinary, you know. And I mean, I think when we think about architecture today, we think about the four walls, the ceiling, yeah, you know, the floor, and whatever decorations we put inside. We don't think, oh, what type of animal shall we, you know, model it after?
Yeah.
Because it just doesn't really come into our, you know, our way of thinking. But back there, and we're talking 11,000 years ago, as far as Karahan Tepe is concerned, you know, these people were designing things for very functional reasons. And that functionality seems to be associated with communication with some kind of serpent. And from the alignments that exist at the site, which are towards the Milky Way, particularly at the time of the solstices, it seems as if they were focusing their attentions on the Milky Way, but not just any part of it, an area that we know today as the Galactic Bulge. This is a bright area of the Milky Way, and the reason why it's bright is because it is the center of our own Milky Way galaxy. There's a lot of young stars, there's a lot of activity there, and this appears a lot brighter than other parts of the Milky Way. And the alignments at Karahan are very specifically towards this area. The constellations that are in the vicinity of the Galactic Bulge is the stars of Scorpius, the Sagittarius constellation, and the constellation known as Ophiuchus, which means the snake charmer or the snake bearer, almost like a sort of, you know, snake shaman, if you like, right, in the sky. And, you know, I was looking at this and I was thinking, well, somewhere here is a cosmic serpent. What is it? And eventually I came to the conclusion that it had to be the Milky Way itself. The Milky Way was being seen as this huge, great snake in wrapping itself around the world with its head as the galactic bulge. And, you know, these people back then, as far as they're concerned, the soul or the spirit resided in the head. We can tell this by the fact that they would decapitate the bodies of individuals. They would almost certainly leave the body out to be pecked clean by vultures. And a vulture is really, really important symbol there as well, as far as death and resurrection. But the heads would be kept aside, almost certainly cleaned up, and used thereafter as points of communication with the owners. In other words, you know, it was believed that access to the spirit or soul of a person was via their skull, via their head. And if you then transfer this into the sky, you know, you've got this huge, great cosmic serpent wrapped around the world, which you would see, you know, in some form every night. But it's the head that they're interested in, because that's the point of communication, the point of contact. And, you know, the fact that the stars of Scorpius are right in front of it as well, it almost seems like they are coming out of the mouth of the cosmic serpent, almost like its tongue, or as I describe in the book, almost like its active spirit. In other words, the communication that's coming from it is represented by the stars of Scorpius. And Scorpius is something that, although we very much associate with scorpions, of course, in many parts of the world, the Scorpius stars are actually a snake. I mean, even in North America, amongst various Native American tribes, I mean, you know, Serpent Mound in Adams County, Ohio, that has been proposed to be a representation of the Scorpius constellation. And I think that that's absolutely correct. It represents the active spirit of this cosmic serpent in the sky. So I think that that's what they were focusing on. So then the question becomes, why were they doing this? I mean, what was going on? And I think a lot of it is to do with bringing information into the here and now, into the material reality in which they lived. And they did this, I think, through altered states of consciousness, achieving trance states and connecting with this cosmic serpent, almost certainly by going into these chambers that were shaped like the heads of snakes. I mean, you know, you have to ask yourself, why would you create a room in exactly the shape of a snake? And you know, with a tiny little entrance at the front of it that you would crawl through to go into the mouth of that snake. And I think the answer to this is that they wanted to be consumed by the snake itself. In other words, the idea was quite literally to be eaten by the snake, to become at one with it, to become a part of it. And of course, you see similar things with the vulture. For instance, I mean, the vulture is another very, very important symbol, both at Korahan and also at Göbekli Tepe, where it features on the very famous Pillar 43. And this represents a psychopomp, a soul carrier, a soul accompanier, you know, the vehicle by which the soul is able to go from this world, you know, let's say the middle world, to either the sky world or the lower world, or the underworld, as you might want to also call it. You know, it's the psychopomp. It carries the soul from one place to the next. But how does it do that? It does that by consuming the body of an individual, quite literally eating it. So, you know, when that vulture flies away, it's flying away with some part of you inside it. And of course, obviously, it then becomes part of a belief system to see, well, you know, that vulture is not just carrying off your meat, as it were, it's also carrying off some part of yourself, some part of your soul into the next world. And this begins to give us an idea of how these people may have thought, what they were trying to achieve. The ultimate goals of this, well, Göbekli Tepe, it's a little bit more difficult. As I said, I would treat Göbekli almost like a cathedral. You know, a cathedral is somewhere that's got a high altar. It's very big. Yeah, but you've also got a load of other chapels off on the side dedicated to the Virgin Mary, the different saints or whatever. And that's very much like I see Göbekli, whereas Tarahan is almost like a Gnostic church or, you know, somewhere where you go into the much deeper mysteries of reality to try and answer fundamental questions like, you know, where do we come from? Why are we here? You know, is there something higher than us? What is our relationship to the cosmos and the cycles of you know, the celestial cycles, the sun, the moon, the eclipses? You know, how do they relate to us? How do they affect us? And of course, what you're also seeing with this is the beginnings of astrology. You know, and it's no coincidence that the astrology, certainly in the West, begins just a few miles away from Karahan Tepe at the ancient city of Haran, which was also the place of origin of Hermetica, you know, the Corpus Hermeticum, the books of Hermes. It's also almost certainly the place of origin of the tarot pack, believe it or not, as well.
Oh, really? Wow.
And, you know, there was occupation at Haran going back at least to 8,000 BC, making it contemporary with the very end, at least, of Karahan Tepe and, of course, Göbekli Tepe, and, of course, the many other so-called Taş Tepe'li sites in this region, of which there are officially 12, although, you know, there are definitely more, but the official, and I know this because I was actually talking to an archaeologist at a site named Sefer Tepe just a few days ago, and, you know, and I said to her, you know, how many official Taş Tepe'li sites are there? And she said 12. I said, officially, she said, well, that's all there is. I said, well, yeah, but there's also more. But anyway, we won't get into that debate at the moment. But so that's the sort of stuff we're after at these sites, really.
Thank you for that. Yeah, that is fascinating. And I think you're right. It's a whole serpent motif. It's so primordial. And as you write in your book, and we've discussed on this show, of course, we discuss a lot, is the idea the serpent was so holy to so many groups, including the Gnostics. You bring in the Ophites, which the serpent was essential, and the Egyptians, and Atum. And of course, with the Gnostics, there's more than that, the Essenes, Manichaeans, Sethians. It's all serpents here and there, especially in that area. And Jesus was associated with a serpent. Sophia was associated with a serpent. So it is truly primordial. But the question, Andrew, these tepes, Göbekli Tepe, is said to have been buried. Was this one buried too? And do we have any evidence why they buried it? Maybe they were avoiding the tax man or tax season or yeah. Something like that.
Well, I think there are two ways that things get buried. One is accidental, and this would be the slipping and sliding of you know, soil and rubble, probably through you know, alluvial action of rains and things like that, that would pour down this debris onto enclosures and fill them in. And in all honesty, that's what some of the archaeologists working on the sites today believe, that this was an accidental process. But Dr. Nejmi Karol, of the University of Istanbul, who's been working at Karahan Tepe since 2018, you know, he has written a paper strongly suggesting that the enclosures there were very deliberately buried. I mean, and not just with any old rubble and soil that they could get their hands on, very specifically layered, including types of soil that were not native to the location. In other words, they would have to go somewhere to get the soil, to bring it to the site, to actually use it as a deposit within these enclosures. And I'm talking specifically about this pillar shrine that we've been talking about. You know, and then rubble, and then even the tops of the pillars that are cut out of the bedrock would have like slabs of rock put on top of those, and that would eventually reach the level of the bedrock above so that you could actually see where those pillars still were. You know, in other words, this was all very deliberate. The question then becomes, why would you do it? And I think the easiest way to answer that question is to say, well, why do we give humans burials? And that's to put them to rest, basically, to calm the spirit, to allow the spirit to move on. And I think it was exactly the same with these enclosures. There was an active spirit within them. They believed in a consciousness that existed in everything, I think, you know, within rocks, within nature, within the structures that they were creating, particularly if they were shaping them to look like the heads of snakes. I mean, quite clearly that would give you the view that these were serpentine in nature, that they had their own consciousness, their own sentience, so that at the end of their useful life, which, by the way, at Karahan Tepe was probably about 8,000 BC. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in other words, that they'd been in use for a thousand, maybe as much as 1,500 years in some cases, that they put them to rest, basically. They decommissioned them. And, of course, this is something that we do, even to this day, with churches, with mosques, with temples. You know, if they fall out of use, they can't just be left, you know, as holy places. Right. They have to be properly decommissioned, you know, by priests or imams or whatever. And I think that it's a combination of these processes that was going on to make them be buried in that way. I mean, obviously, some of my colleagues, you know, will see more sensational reasons why they buried it. You know, there was maybe another cataclysm coming along or something like that. And I mean, who knows? Maybe there's an element of that. But I think that from the evidence we have so far, that it was deliberate burials based on a decommissioning process.
No, that makes sense, because even with the Mayans is the same way. When I went to the Yucatan, people have been asking for decades, well, why did the Mayans simply abandon a lot of their cities? And people said, an environmental disaster, all that. But what you say makes perfect sense. The spirit spoke and it was time to move on to somewhere else.
Absolutely. And that's it. And when you say the spirit spoke, I mean, that's very apt, I think, because what I think was going on in the main enclosures at Karahan is a form of oracle, mm-hmm. In the same sense as the oracle of Delphi. And of course, what happened at Delphi, you had a priestess who was known as the oracle or the Pythia.
Right.
And they would sit on this tripod-shaped seat, and the fumes from a supposedly dead serpent, remember that, not just any old fumes, from a decomposing serpent beneath the ground, would rise up and intoxicate them and allow the god Apollo to possess them. And they could then make pronouncements, obviously, to attendees, those that were listening. And of course, this would decide the fate not only of, you know, kings, of nations, but also of the gods themselves. So these were very, very powerful things, these oracle centers. And a lot of people say, Apollo is Apollo, you know, he's a god, you know, he was coming through. But what a lot of people don't realize is that the form of Apollo that would appear under these circumstances was as a snake. I go into this in the book. You know, that was one of his forms. And what this also tells me is that the cult of Apollo, when it took over the oracle at Delphi, was taking over something that was much more ancient, much more primeval, that had pre-existed. It was probably a matriarchal cult that existed at that site before, you know, the priests of Apollo came there and said, you know, this is a place of our god Apollo, I think. But of course, what they did was they had to retain the method by which, you know, these oracles were able to speak in tongues, and that was to allow snakes to enter inside them. And I mean, this, I think, is one of the reasons why there's so much snake imagery, mm-hmm. at Karahan Tepe. And what's interesting is that they've recently uncovered a new enclosure at Karahan Tepe, which we're affectionately referring to as the kitchen. It's got a hearth in it. You know, it looks like a working area. I mean, and yeah, you know, it could be a place of preparation. But what's interesting is that they found a large number of snake bones, but in there, but not just any old snake, a snake known as the Anatolian Meadow Viper. And this is interesting because prior to this discovery, which I only knew about a year ago, it was the head of the Anatolian Meadow Viper that I used to synchronize with the overhead shape of the pillar shrine because it fitted perfectly. And now we have absolute confirmation not only that the Tashtepala people were aware of that particular species of viper, but that they were doing stuff with it. I mean, what they were doing, we can't say. I mean, they could have been eating it, although that seems sort of unlikely, I think. I think that they were using it as part of their rituals. You know, they may be using its venom. They were maybe crushing it up, maybe using its bones as far for shamanic activity. But yeah, this is good confirmation that we're on the right track with how they interpreted the snake, what it was there for. And this idea of allowing a snake to enter inside you is something that you find in many different religions.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I mean, to start off with, I mean, the first thing I thought of, and obviously I put this in the book, I think, is that, you know, with ayahuasca, you know, lots of people have very similar experiences on ayahuasca. And one of the things that the people keep telling me, and I have written about this in books, is that they see snakes. They see snakes that you know, crawl around, wrap around trees or around doorways or whatever. But often they will see a single large snake that will approach them and want to enter inside them. Now, you know, I'm sure that there's a lot of psychology somewhere going on here, but this is a frequent thing. And I'm sure some of your listeners will probably say, yeah, you know, something similar happened to me. And I think that if you see this as like some kind of external influence be entering into you, and that once it's there, it can literally speak through your tongue, you know, and I think this is significant. And I mean, there's so many different areas that we can go off from here. I mean, obviously the whole concept of speaking in tongues is something that right. is familiar, you know, from religions, even within Christianity. But the idea of the forked tongue, that somebody speaks with a forked tongue, I didn't realize this until I was writing the book, is commonly thought to derive from the way that the serpent of Eden in the Garden of Eden tricked Adam and Eve into eating of the forbidden fruit, which is something also I go into in the book about what that is. Yeah, I mean, speaking in tongues, speaking with a forked tongue, that term comes from, you know, our interpretation of the book of Genesis story, which brings us nicely, obviously, on to, you know, the serpent of Eden. And what was that? And how does that fit into the story? Well,
yeah.
Here's a certain amount of facts. The book of Genesis, obviously the first book of the Old Testament, much of it is set in southeastern Anatolia, modern day Turkey. Whether it be stories of the Garden of Eden, you know, there are various places in southeast Turkey and in eastern Turkey that claim to be that. When I say various, there's at least three that I know of. One of those is Şanlıurfa. That's the city closest to Göbekli Tepe. And here, right through to the present day, as you're reading the book, people have this belief of that this was the terrestrial paradise. This is where God placed the soul of Adam down on earth. And from the red earth thereabouts, he was created, and obviously from him, the story goes that Eve is created, and they were in the garden there. And of course, the serpent comes along, he tempts them, they eat of the the tree of knowledge of good and evil. They realize that they're naked. They lose their innocence. God realizes what's going on and banishes them from the garden, lest they eat of the other tree, which is the tree of life, and gain immortality. And obviously with the serpent himself, who at that time, remember, has got arms and legs. He's then cast to the ground. His arms and legs are taken away, and you will forever slither along the floor. And according to the local legends at Llanlurfa, Adam and Eve go on to the nearby Haran Plain. Now, this is the same place where the city of Haran is. It's a very fertile area. It's the center of Tash Tepelo, I'm sure, as far as you know, their agriculture and the, you know, the beginning of domesticated wheat and whatever. And it's actually said that here, Adam and Eve create the earliest agriculture and wheat. How do they create wheat? Well, according to the story, they scratch their heads and say, you know, what are we going to grow? And Eve opens her hand and says, oh, how about growing some of this stuff that I brought out of the Garden of Eden? And she's got a stalk of wheat in her hand. So they say, yeah, that's a great idea. So that's how, according to this story, which is still told to this day, I mean, not just orally by the people of Llanlurfa, which, by the way, anciently was known as Adama, by the way, which means the place of Adam. Right. This is one of the most ancient names. I mean, I've got the references to this. It's all in the book. A reference to the fact that, it was from the red earth there that Adam was created. And as I said, I think it's too much of a coincidence, the fact that agriculture is created for the first time. And when I say created, what I mean by that is domesticated wheat is used in a widespread motion for the first time in that area, for the first time in human history. I mean, there were experiments with agriculture. There were experiments with wild wheat going back 30,000 years. I mean, the Tash Tepelo people didn't invent, wheat growing. They didn't. However, the domestication of it would seem to have taken place. And it's something like 50 to 60 different varieties of wheat used today to create bread, pasta, cakes, and of course beer.
Very important.
And has its origin, its point of origin, with a wild form of wheat that grows within sight of Göbekli Tepe to this day. I mean, yeah, that I think is amazing. We also know that the earliest beer was grown in the area, and was brewed at places like Göbekli Tepe, and almost certainly, Karahan as well. We also know that the earliest wine, they trace back the sources of grapes and their origins and whatever. I wrote all about this in one of my earlier books. It's not in the Karahan book. And they traced it back to an area very close to a pre-pottery Neolithic site called Chionu, which is just north of the big city of Diyarbakir in southeast Anatolia. So you've got all of these firsts for humanity, the earliest monumental architecture, the earliest beer, the earliest wheat, the earliest wine, the earliest agriculture, animal husbandry, the earliest metalwork at Chionu, which is the earliest use of beaten copper, the earliest linen, all these firsts for humanity all occur in this area. And you have to say, why? Why was it all taking place there? And I would say that these innovations were being inspired intuitively through their communications with what they perceived as this higher intelligence, this cosmic intelligence that they interpreted as a snake, and that this is the true source of the Serpent of Eden.
I would agree, and well said, and I think you're right. I think they were looking at the stars, and you can say, well, is it true? Is it inspiration? It doesn't matter, right, Andrea? We should do that again. Look at the stars just to be inspired. We can break new ground. And what they were doing was just incredible.
Yeah, and obviously, I mean, we think in terms of God, for instance, and you know, where do we look for God? We don't look for him in a hole in the ground. You know, we look for him up in the sky.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I think these people believe that the source of their own cosmic intelligences were coming from. They saw it in terms of a snake or a serpent. But I think there's more. We talked briefly about Gnosticism, and we're talking very specifically about Orphites. Now, Orphites basically is from the Greek word orphis, orphis, which means snake.
Right.
In other words, these people were venerators of the snake. So what does that mean? You know, well, yes, of course, their rituals did seem to involve real snakes. There's no question about that. I talk about that in the book. However, the snake for them was almost like a demiurge, a creator of the world, basically. Mm-hmm. It was, in their terms, the sun. And the father was God on high. And how did they perceive God on high? Well, they perceived it as almost like some kind of invisible sun, basically, that existed beyond the physical universe itself, within a sort of primordial chaos, and that it was so far removed from, you know, the physical universe that it had to have its son to intercede on its behalf. And that son was a snake, a cosmic serpent. So these are the elements that you find. And what the Gnostics were trying to do was to achieve Gnosticism. Obviously, this oneness mm-hmm. with ultimate knowledge and ultimate wisdom, which was, you know, almost like a sort of a form of rapture, if you like, of entanglement with, you know, the sun, the snake itself, which is one of the reasons why they used the snake. And it's no coincidence that this form of Gnosticism seems to have its roots in the area of southeastern Turkey, places like Harran, and Şanlıurfa, as I show. I mean, Şanlıurfa, which in biblical times was known as Edessa, mm-hmm. this was a center of so many weird underground cults. I mean, the books have been written specifically about the weird cults there, including serpent cults and Gnostic cults. And, you know, some of the little knowledge we have of Gnostic masses and rites that were taking place all come from this region or just below it in northern Syria. You know, I've seen places like Aleppo and Damascus and places like this, you know, that benefited from a lot of these ideas in much later periods of time. But if you have to sort of put your fingers on two places where this all begins, it's Harran and Urfa, or Şanlıurfa as it's known today. And these are the clearinghouses of all of this knowledge and wisdom, which I think had been, you know, simmering and existing and surviving all the way down from the Taş Templar age.
Exactly. Well said. And yeah, interesting you mentioned the ayahuasca. I've done ayahuasca maybe 20 times throughout the years. And my visions have always been burial or sky ascension. But the first and only time my wife did ayahuasca, guess what, Andrew? She's dying. Who comes to visit her? A snake approaches her and wants to come inside her. But she denied the snake. So you're right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the interesting thing. I mean, somebody was talking to me about this a while ago, and they said this snake, it was a man. He said that this snake came up to him and basically told him he wanted to enter inside him.
Yeah, exactly.
And he said, you know, no, sorry.
My wife too.
But, you know, he thought about it afterwards and he realized that this wasn't going to be a negative experience. This was going to be a transformative experience. And, you know, he vowed that when he went back, you know, I think somewhere I know, like, you know, Mexico or wherever it was, where this happened, I think Toulon, I think, that, yeah, he would allow that snake to enter inside him next time. And I mean, obviously, by this point, I was also onto all of this Gnostic stuff and its relationship to Cara Han. So I said, yeah, go for it. I mean, because I think that it could be very important, you know. And I think what's also worth mentioning is that there are religious cults in the world today where snakes are deliberately, or the spirits of snakes are deliberately allowed to enter inside people. You know, whether it's the Obeah, you know, religions of Haiti, you know, the voodoo and religions there, where, you know, snakes enter inside, you know, the practitioners, they will fall on the ground and writhe around like snakes. And the same thing happens at this huge, great snake festival in Thailand that I describe in the book. Same thing. They allow snakes to enter inside them. You know, after they've earlier got tattoos with snakes done, very specific tattoos, which are often done involving snake venom, interestingly enough. And the snake is allowed to enter inside them during this festival. And once again, people will crawl, you know, literally slither along the ground as snakes. And although this might sound extreme, I think that something similar was going on at Korahan Tepe. You know, we cannot look at places like Korahan Tepe and think of, you know, a modern day temple or a modern day church or mosque or something like this. These are functional places where the relationship between this world and the next would have been full on, absolute full on. And so people probably would have been writhing around like snakes. They would have been speaking in tongues, but the information that they'd be given to attendees would be something that could be translated and, you know, utilized by the community in the same way as it was within the Oracle at Delphi. I mean, obviously that was a much more formalized process, but I think it's the same thing with the same outcomes, you know. And what I think we also should look upon is how this affected Vedic religion, because there's a clear relationship between Tash Tepala and Vedic religion. And when I say Vedic, I mean, obviously, I'm talking, you know, Hindu, but it could be pre-Vedic. And what I'm talking about is the whole system of what we would know as the chakras, Kundalini, you know, through yoga and, you know, tantric practices. Now, this, as we know, involves a series of so-called energy centers that are coincident to the spine, you know, seven of them, of course, you know, the seven chakras, very westernized, of course, but, you know, it's basically something that definitely is real and existed in the Indian subcontinent, you know, long before Westerners reached there. And of course, what is one of the main processes of this enlightenment? And it's raising the Kundalini spirit. And the Kundalini spirit is a snake that rises up inside the body, not by coming through the head or anything, but by rising up from the area of what, you know, used to be referred to as the cathedra, the area between the legs, because this is obviously where the base chakra is. And that energy then rises up to empower the person and also to bring with it ultimate enlightenment. And I mean, as I was writing all this, a friend of mine who practices Tantra and has done for many decades under a guru, I said to her, I said, you know, what is Tantra? I mean, you know, yes, I know there's supposed to be a sexual element to it. I know it's about
small Kundalini, percentage, you know, actually. Yeah.
It's, but what is it? You know, what is its function? What? And I said, I understand it's about enlightenment. And she said, yes, it is. But it's not simply that. It's actually about gaining a supernatural power. But she said that this is never publicized by, you know, tantric schools because it will attract the wrong type of people. And when I heard this, I thought, oh, my God, that's exactly, I think, what they were trying to do at places like Korahan and other Tash Tepala sites. I mean, one of the most common imagery that you see in the carvings are male figures holding their private parts. I mean, you see it at Göbekli Tepe. There's Urfa Man, this huge, great 6-foot statue that was found at the site of a early pre-pottery Neolithic site inside the city of Shanlurfa. It's there on a new panel found at a site called Saiburj, just a few miles to the west of Shanlurfa. And it's there at Korahan Tepe. There was a huge, great statue found there last year, 7.5 feet tall, even wow, in a sitting position. I mean, it is a giant. It's a veritable giant And all of them seem to be holding their private parts, basically, their genitalia. And people immediately look at this and say, oh, it's obviously something to do with sex. And I said, no, it's not. It's not to do with sex. Well, I mean, there's a sexual element to it. It's an energy, a power that rises up from that part of the body and fills the body so that you can achieve an almost supernatural power. And what I mean by that, I mean control over your environment, control over the beasts, control over animals, control over your neighbours. And that begins in the area which is referred to as the base chakra. And it's also no coincidence, I think, that in Vedic tradition, in Tantra and Yogic, that area is associated with the constellation of Scorpius, the power of the stars of Scorpius, just as it is in Babylonian tradition. There is a concept known as zodiac man. Basically, it's the 12 signs of the zodiac have an influence over one part of the body. You know, obviously Libra controls this, Capricorn controls the head, whatever it is. I can't remember exactly which order they go. But it's Scorpius that controls the area of the cathedra and the private parts, basically. And it's exactly the same in Vedic tradition. And so the fact that we know that the influence of this cosmic serpent is coming from the same area as the stars of Scorpius in the sky and the galactic bulge, it's almost like as above, so below. You contact the cosmic serpent, you're allowing it to enter you, but it doesn't come in through the head, it comes in through the cathedra and rises up into the body, exactly the same concept as Kundalini. And I think all of this is linked. And I try to show the relationship of it all.
Yeah, no, you make an excellent case with some excellent research. But let's bring in Graham. Graham, I'm sure you have questions. Let us know. Take it away.
Oh, no, absolutely. I was going to say, I appreciate Andrew bringing up Haran, which is, I was unaware of the corpus hermeticum and the tarot standpoint. And I'm sure he's aware of the rumors of Abraham actually coming from San Lurfa, where Ur of the Chaldees was actually San Lurfa. And that was much more sensible start of his trip.
Yeah, no, I mean, the whole story of Abraham, I mean, that's something that's retold by guides at Shan Lurfa to this day, that this was the place of the birth of Abraham. They will take you to a cave. It's a holy shrine. Thousands of people visit it every month. And they say that this is where Abraham was brought up. This is where he was brought up from a child through to adulthood. And what they say is that, he decided that he would worship the one God, that would become, the God of the Israelites, Yahweh, and that his father had a shop there, and his father made idols. And one day his father departed the scene and said to Abraham, look, would you look after the shop for me? And so he did, but the first thing he did was to get the equivalent of a baseball bat and smash all of these idols, except for one. And, he puts the baseball bat or whatever it is, on the one remaining idol. And, and people come in and say, what the hell's gone on there? And he points to this idol and says, he did it, basically. it's a weird story with other elements of it, which I've forgotten at the moment. But, and because of this, the king who ruled there, again, a legendary figure known as Nimrod, decides that he's going to kill Abraham. So he arrests him. He throws him on this sort of like funeral pyre and is lighting this. So the flames will begin to lick up and consume Abraham. And God intervenes to change the firewood into fish and the fire into water. And this becomes what's known today as the Pools of Abraham, which have hundreds and thousands of these huge carp in it. So that's the story. And all that is there in Schanlerfer, basically. I'm sure I didn't say her name, but so anyway, so yeah. And of course, according to the book of Genesis, Abraham is born in this place called Ur Kasdem, which we interpret as Ur of the Chaldees. Now, the term Chaldees means two things. I mean, it means the astrologers and the astronomers and even soothsayers of Haran and Schanlerfer, but it's a term that was much earlier used to refer to the peoples of eastern and southeastern Anatolia in general, from the word Kaldi, which was the name of a god. They were the people of Kaldi, and Kaldi was almost like a personification of the land. He protected them. He was also their war god, you know, would help them in battle. So, yeah, the Chaldeans were the people of southeastern Turkey, and they're the ones that eventually become known as the astrologer. They're the ones that teach the Babylonians, for instance. And obviously, people might be saying, well, hold on, you know, isn't Ur of the Chaldees a city and a royal cemetery in Lower Iraq? Wasn't it found by Sir Leonard Woolley, the famous British archaeologist in the 1920s? He wrote a book called Ur of the Chaldees to record all this. Yeah, the only problem with this is that during the early years of archaeology, virtually all expeditions were funded by biblical societies. And what they would, you know, their brief would be, look, here's lots of money. You can go off and do your archaeology thing. But what we want you to do is find evidence that the Bible is real. And so that was always in the back of their minds. So when Leonard Woolley found an inscription that mentioned the word Ur as a city, he announced that he'd found Ur of the Chaldees, which was obviously this legendary city that's in the Bible, and obviously mentioned in folklore and tradition as well. I don't think that was correct whatsoever, because before this time, all of the folk traditions seemed to focus around the area of Urfa in particular. Obviously, you know, Urfa itself, you know, contains the word Ur. But I don't think that's enough. But the traditions to do with Abraham and that city go back at least 2,000 years. Skeptics and theologians would say, no, they don't. They're only medieval and they were only created at the time of the Crusaders. That's absolutely untrue. I've got references that go back 2,000 years for it and show exactly the same story. And it's clearly referring to, you know, the area of Schanlerfer. And the thing is that he leaves Schanlerfer after God speaks to him and says, you know, you're going to go now to the promised land. So he moves from Urfa to Haran. Now, I mean, this is only about 25 miles away, but it's where his father lived, Terah. And secondly, it's an obvious stop on a journey that's going to be taking you down through Syria into what is today the Palestinian West Bank, which is where he ends up, a place which is now marked by the city of Nablus. But in the past, it was the city of Shechem, above which was this towering mountain called Gerizim, which I've written about in books, which was the original mountain of God. So, you know, that's where he went. But of course, the skeptics say, oh, well, you know, Urfa is too close to Haran. That can't be a journey. It's just one day's journey. So what's the problem with that? I mean, you know, you're telling me that he was in lower Iraq and he then went all the way to Haran in southeastern Anatolia and then all the way down to, you know, to the Palestinian West Bank on his journey. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But, you know, I will keep telling this story until I die, basically, because I think that this is the truth. And obviously Graham has heard this as well. And that's great.
Oh, 100% Andrew. That was when I read it as a kid, when it went from, you know, the Persian Gulf up to Haran and then down to the Holy Land, when I first heard about the Cave of Abraham and that tradition. It's like, this makes so much more sense. Follow-up question on Karahan Tepe and Göbekli Tepe is, They seem to be like ritual initiation places, and I was unaware of the vipers and the snakes before, and those could have been used to prepare some sort of psychoactive, drink or preparation for the initiations, because it seems that they seem to have man-made caves, as you said, and ritual bathing, perhaps purification as well there.
Yeah.
And last aside is any thought that there might be a tie-in to Derinkuyu, which is, it's about 350 miles away, but you can't date stone. So I'm going to tag on those.
Yeah. I mean, obviously quite a lot there. I mean, firstly, yeah, these were places of initiation. I have no doubt about that at all. Yes, they would have almost certainly had water within them at certain times. I think this was part of a cosmological notion to do with what's known as the cosmic ocean. This was something that was considered to exist outside of everything that was physical, the physical universe, the starry heavens, the earth, the underworld, the oceans that we perceive. That beyond that was something called the cosmic ocean, out of which everything came originally. And so the water reflected that, quite literally reflected it. We think that water was brought in probably, I mean, how much, we don't know. I mean, it could have just been a few inches. It could have been, a few feet worth. We don't know. But was introduced as part of these rituals within probably the pillar shrine and the one that's next to it, which we call the pit shrine, both of which are shaped like the head of a snake. So, yeah, these initiations, but the initiations were to, I think, allow people to get into this state where they would be able to communicate with the cosmic serpent, that represented by the Milky Way, and the movement of the sun and the moon. I mean, certainly in later times, this cosmic serpent also becomes associated with the ecliptic, the path that's, along which the sun moves during its yearly cycle, on which, of course, is the 12 signs of the zodiac, and a 13th sign, Ophiuchus, the snake bearer or snake charmer, which basically has its foot, as far as it's drawn in Greek, star lore, with its foot on galactic center. And I think that this is something which, maybe we should just have a quick word about, because the galactic bulge does synchronize with galactic center, the center of our own Milky Way galaxy. And in theory, the ancients can't possibly have been aware that that is where the center of our galaxy were. They wouldn't have even had the concept or notion of us being a part of, a galaxy, if you like. But having said that, I think that there is every possibility that intuitively they felt that there was something important in that direction. Certainly that area of the sky would have been much brighter than, than any other part, certainly the brightest part of the Milky Way. And that there was something special or something important about it, and that the stars around it, whether they were Ophiuchus, Scorpius or Sagittarius, were, the key to not just communication with this, but almost like a gateway, into this cosmic realm. And it's no coincidence, I think, that the sun passes the Milky Way in two places in the sky. One is in the area of Scorpius and Sagittarius and Ophiuchus, and on the other side of the sky, it's in the area of Gemini and Taurus and the constellation of Orion and also the Pleiades. These are known as these ancient gates, through which people on Earth at certain times of the year, particularly the solstices, could gain access to the sky world. They could quite literally, make a leap of faith through these sky gates and enter onto the Milky Way. And the Milky Way becomes another really important route to the sky world. So it doesn't just function as the body of a snake, but it's also a waterway. It's also a road. It's also, you know, the quest, really, that the soul has to undergo to achieve transformation, to return back to its cosmic state, which I think was seen in terms of this cosmic ocean.
Well said. And yes, we agree on this show. I've done many shows on the Gnostics and their star portals and doing exactly that, going out through Draco and all these constellation. It was in the air, but yeah, we are at the end. But before we say goodbye, Andrew, would you want to mention that there have been some issues with people with excavating and getting there recently? Again, putting on my suspicious hat, if you know what I mean, because this information, like we keep you, like I mentioned, is consciousness changing.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of talk at the moment about Göbekli Tepe and whether excavations are going to be delayed for 150 years and the World Economic Forum taking control of it and concrete on. And I'll be honest, a lot of those stories are, they have a grain of truth in them, but they've been blown out of all proportion. I mean, firstly, there's no concrete on Göbekli Tepe itself. Other than in what the where the pillars that hold up the roof, yes, there was some concrete that had to be put in the base there, and yes, that may have disturbed some archaeology. Although they did do excavations within those holes first, down to what I presume was the bedrock. Secondly, the whole idea of the excavations being held off for 150 years—that's not the case. They're opening up new areas of excavation next year. Now, this maybe, just maybe, have been prompted by all these stories that are rumoured. Maybe they've thought, no, you know, we need to start relooking at it. There certainly was a time when there was no excavations for about 5 or 6 years. But over the last 2 or 3 years, they've been clearing out the enclosures that they've already been working on. They're doing that this moment. They're uncovering some new carvings and that, which we got to see. But at Kara Hantepe, it's a completely different show. There, the archaeologists are working as fast as they can to uncover the whole entire site. And I think the reason for this is that there's probably different, you know, different archaeologists at the helm with different views. They're mostly Turkish there. I think they have a slightly different attitude to, you know, some of the archaeologists from other countries. But I mean, you know, these places are being uncovered now. There is no hideous conspiracy or whatever. And I've brought together everything that is known about Karahan. It's a 20-year journey. I first went there in 2004. When I first went there, there was no excavations. There was just, you know, you could see the T-pillars. They were just sticking out of the ground, just their head, just about sea. And I mean, one last thing I'll say is that when I first went there, I went there as part of a cultural festival at Diyarbakır, which I was asked to lecture. And I was given a driver and an interpreter. And we got to the site and, you know, we're just looking around and we could see the tops of these T-pillars. We could see fragments of what are known as porthole stones, like these angular carved stones, which look like something out of a medieval building, and yet they're 11,000 years old. They're just scattered about here and there. And I saw just a fragment of a T-pillar, and I wanted to know if there was you know, any carving on it. So I put my hand underneath it, because you could slide your hand underneath it. And the driver, who was this big, burly Kurdish guy, you know, saw what I was doing, came across and just lifted it up, and it sort of, you know, fell to the other side. And where my hand had been was this big blue scorpion. And it just really shocked me, because I thought, oh, my God, you know, I could have just been stung or, you know, literally died. Whatever that would have happened, it wouldn't have been pretty. And that really affected me. And, you know, that inspired me at the time. But what I now realize is that the constellation of Scorpius in particular is arguably the most important constellation associated with Karahan Tepei. So that encounter with that scorpion, which is the only scorpion I've ever seen in Southeast Turkey. I've never ever encountered one since. You know, it was almost like a strange omen.
Yeah,
it was almost like the sight speaking to me and said, look in this direction for answers. So, wow. You know, that story is in the book, by the way. So
yes, it is. Yes, it is. Wonderful book. And yes, so much more. And check it out. But we are at the end. Andrew, where do you want to send people? It'll be in the show notes. What website?
Well, I mean, obviously, for the book, go straight to Amazon or Barnes & Noble. You can purchase it now straight away. In America, in other parts of the world, you'll have to wait, I'm afraid, for just a little while longer. As to events in Britain, we got the Origins event, which I do with my colleague Hugh Newman every year. That's November the 2nd. And we do, tours out to Turkey twice a year. The next one is in May 2025, and again in September 2025. So all the details for those or what all that's available right now is on andrewcollins.com, which you can obviously read all about these subjects, introductions to this book and to, you know, various other books that I've done in the past, going back an awful long time.
Wonderful. Check it out. And again, it will be in the show notes. But we are at the end of our excavation. First, I'd like to say, Graham, thanks for keeping us company and the great questions.
Oh, my great pleasure. It's fun asking some questions to Andrew.
Hey. Yes, and Andrew, thank you very much.
Well, thank you both for your questions.
Yeah, we appreciate coming on the show, and good luck with all your work. And yeah, keep following the stars, and yeah, listen to the scorpion.
Indeed, and don't get stung.
Don't get stung, yes. And there you have it, my beloved Truth Seeker Warriors. Andrew killing it softly with his gnosis. Love his research and contributions. As mentioned in the intro, and as a bonus for all subs, Graham Pong provides his research on how Andrew's work ties into his discoveries about Atlantis and the secret truth about human evolution. Don't want to miss it, and coming right up for all subs. For all non-subs, please support this Red Pill Cafeteria in any way you can, joining AB Prime, Patreon, or Red Circle. One-time donations on Stripe, PayPal, or crypto really help. Tips on YouTube or any podcast description also help. There is also the merch store or my Amazon wish list. You can also join the Finding Hermes private group, or whatever. It all helps keep the lights of the Pleroma on, as we undoubtedly enter some violent and dark times in 2025. But Julian of Norwich did say, all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well, especially if you're awake. Let us to the bonus with Graham for all subs. For everyone else, hello and goodbye, as always.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.